Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a sport-tuned suspension. Learn more at Acura.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When two top scholars from Harvard and the University of Chicago, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, lobbed a grenade into the U.S. foreign policy debate, they got the explosion they asked for. They say the U.S. has harmed its own national interest because it has listened too closely to a hardline pro-Israel lobby. This hour, On Point, Walt and Mearsheimer make their case on America, its Israel lobby, and its policy in the Middle East. We will hear from these two scholars in this hour. We will hear from you, and we will hear from two top American diplomats, Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller, who have their own views of the critique and reality of U.S.-Israel ties. Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. John Mearsheimer is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. They are co-authors of the new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Both join us from Washington. Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, welcome.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Nice to be here, Tom.
John Mearsheimer, let me come first to you. Give us the core arguments of the case you make in The Israel Lobby.
Well, the basic argument, Tom, is that there is this powerful lobby in the United States that is concerned with pushing American foreign policy in directions that are favorable to Israel. It's important to emphasize that we're not arguing that this lobby is pushing on purpose American policy in ways that are detrimental to the United States. That's not our argument. But it's mainly concerned with pushing American foreign policy in ways that support Israel. That's the first part of the argument. And the second part of the argument is that we believe that American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, is misguided and not in the American national interest. And this is due largely to the force of the lobby.
Stephen Walt, you make the case that there is not, or perhaps no longer, a strategic or moral, your words, rationale for the very deep U.S. relationship with Israel. Let's hear that argument.
Well, we say in the book that we believe there's a strong moral case for Israel's existence, and we believe the United States should come to Israel's aid if its survival were ever in jeopardy. The good news there is its survival is not in jeopardy. But we believe there isn't a strong strategic argument for backing Israel unconditionally, that Israel is, in fact, not much of a strategic asset to the United States, especially now that there's no Cold War to wage, and especially given the problems the United States has throughout the Middle East. Moreover, given the prolonged occupation in the West Bank and more recently or previously in Gaza and Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, there is no compelling moral case for giving Israel the kind of unconditional backing that the United States has provided over the years. So again, we think there's a moral case for Israel's existence, and we actually support the existence of the State of Israel quite strongly, but we don't think American policy towards Israel or more broadly in the Middle East should be so unconditional, given the fact that it's now increasingly a strategic liability and there's no compelling moral case for unconditional support.
You write that, quoting you here, many policies pursued on Israel's behalf now jeopardize U.S. national security. That's your assessment. Yet you say those policies go on because of the Israel lobby. John Mearsheimer, how do you define or describe the Israel lobby? That's a big, broad, to my mind, ambiguous term.
Well, we define the lobby as a loose coalition of individuals and groups that actively work to push American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. We don't define it as a Jewish lobby because the fact of the matter is that not all Jews are deeply committed to Israel, and in no way could you argue that all Jews are part of the lobby. Furthermore, there is an important non-Jewish element in the lobby. A good number of the neoconservatives in the lobby are not Jewish, and the Christian Zionists, of course, are one of the key constituencies in the lobby. So our basic argument is that you have this loose coalition. There are no card-carrying members. There are no There's no central leadership.
That, loose coalition, you know, like what? Who? Where?
Tom, a couple things. It would be, first of all, groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, Christian Zionist groups like Christians United for Israel. There are also a wide array of think tanks, the American Enterprise Institute, very strongly pro-Israel, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy as well, which was created to present sort of pro-Israel research analyses. And the thing to understand here is, like all other special interest groups, this special interest group has many components, both formal lobbying groups, but also supporting institutions that are designed to try and sell essentially the same message. And we make it very clear that what the, quote, Israel lobby, unquote, is doing is as American as apple pie. It's just another special interest group like many other special interest groups, the ARP, the National Rifle Association, the Farm Lobby. There's nothing illegitimate about its activities at all.
This is not a conspiracy or a cabal. Many of our critics misrepresent our argument, Tom, by saying that we're talking about the lobby as if it were some nefarious force, some cabal, something along the lines of what you see in the infamous Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But nothing could be further from the truth. This is good old-fashioned interest group politics. The lobby is just a powerful interest group that has a powerful influence on American foreign policy in the Middle East.
Help me understand the politics of the Israel lobby as you see it. John Mearsheimer, you said you're not talking about the American Jewish community in general because, to quote you, you said not all Jews are committed to Israel. Many certainly are, but are you saying, well, I guess I'd like you to define, what are the politics of the Israel lobby, if it's possible to characterize them, and it's not the same as American Jewry at large?
Well, if you look at public opinion polls within the American Jewish community, what you see is that roughly one-third of American Jews are deeply committed to Israel. Another one-third are committed, but not deeply committed, and roughly one-third feels no powerful allegiance to Israel and does very little to promote Israel's interests in the United States. So you see a very variegated picture. At the same time, if you look at organizations like the Christians United for Israel, John Hagee's organization, you see that there's a deep-seated commitment to the State of Israel and the policies that it's pursuing within that organization and among many Christian Zionists. Mm. So what you have here is a lobby that is not comprised solely of Jews or comprised of all Jews.
Stephen Walt, is commitment to Israel the hallmark of what you would call members of the Israel lobby, or is it a particular kind of commitment, a particular vision of commitment to Israel?
I'd say a couple of things. It's the political agenda, as John was implying, the political agenda that defines the lobby, not ethnicity or religion. And it's important to note that different groups that we would call part of the lobby don't agree on all issues. There are some very hardline groups that believe, for example, that Israel should control all of the occupied territories in perpetuity. There are other groups and individuals within the lobby who favor a two-state solution and would like to see something like that happen. I think the unifying theme in all of these organizations is that they believe the United States and Israel should have a special relationship that's very different than the American relationship with other democracies, and in a sense that the United States should continue to back Israel no matter what Israel does. So many of the key organizations in the lobby, for example, strongly supported Israel last year during the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, even though Israel's policy was both strategically foolish, as many Israelis now realize, and also violated a number of laws of war, and was widely criticized in other democracies around the world. But here in the United States, of course, the key organizations in the lobby wanted the United States to back Israel, even though its policies weren't good for us, and in fact, were not good for Israel either.
We're going to hear voices with a critical view of your research and a very different view of this relationship. But as you see it, John Mearsheimer, what's the downside of the influence of what you call the Israel lobby? As you say, there are many lobbies in this country, and no small number of them related to countries of origin or countries of, you know, a special devotion of one kind or another. What's the downside for the U.S. here?
Well, the downside is that it's damaged American interests in the Middle East and more generally around the world. Just to give you two examples, by supporting Israeli policy in the occupied territories, especially Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians, the United States has done great damage to its reputation in the Arab and Islamic world. And at the same time, it has helped fuel the terrorism problem. Furthermore, it's quite clear that the lobby played a key role, not the sole role, but played a key role in pushing the United States to war against Iraq. And Iraq has turned into one of the greatest strategic blunders in American history. And this obviously is not good for the United States. I would add, Tom, that the policies that we pursue in the Middle East are not only not good for the United States, they're not good for Israel. It would have been much better for Israel if, starting in 1967, when the Israelis captured the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, if the United States had pursued a hardline policy on the settlements and told the Israelis that they could not try to colonize the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It would have been better for Israel, and of course it would have been better for the United States as well.
Yesterday, on NPR's Fresh Air, talking with Terry Gross, Anti-Defamation League ADL head Abe Foxman went on the attack, as he has heavily. He's come out with a book in opposition to Walt and Mearsheimer's work. Here he argues that their criticism, and Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, I want to get your response here, that your criticism taps into a dark vein in European history.
There is, unfortunately, Terry, a history that this plugs into. And that is, not to be overdramatic, but when Hitler began his anti-Semitic campaigns, he did not begin with Aryan supremacy. Hitler charged the Jews as being not loyal Germans, putting their own interests above the interests of the German people, selling out Germany's interests, bringing Germany to its knees, and therefore they don't deserve to live, et cetera, et cetera. When Stalin began his anti-Semitic campaign, it was that the Jews were not loyal Soviets. They didn't have the interest of the Soviet Union, of communism. They had an interest of Zionism. This is what this plugs into.
There, Abe Foxman, head of the ADL, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, you write that the response to the essay that preceded this book was breathtaking. Elliot Abrams called your paper anti-Semitic, Alan Dershowitz as well, George Shultz very critical of it, and not only those two, David Gergen and others. You hear Abe Foxman there saying, he called it defamation, and he says, in effect, whatever your intent, this feeds into an old, what he is called a canard about Jewish sort of behind-the-scenes power that feeds anti-Semitism. What's your response?
I'd say a couple of things. First of all, this is the standard tactic that people like Mr. Foxman have been using for years to try and make it virtually impossible, or at least very dangerous, for anyone to utter anything even slightly critical of Israel, or certainly critical of groups that support Israel in the United States or push a pro-Israeli policy in the United States. And they do this by charging, first by smearing people in various ways, and most importantly by misrepresenting what they say. So if you listen to the Foxman passage that you just played there, it's essentially a guilt by association, right? He's trying to link us to Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
But the history of anti-Semitism is real and is a shameful mark on history. Do you not fear that this could feed into it, whatever your assessment of Abe Foxman's analysis?
The history of anti-Semitism is despicable, and we make this abundantly clear in the book where we condemn it openly, and we point out all of the ways in which our argument is completely different from those various charges. People like Foxman argue that we think the lobby is all-powerful. We don't. We say it's not. We don't say that the lobby controls American foreign policy. But again, they're attempting to misrepresent our argument to make us sound like we're just a new version of these old anti-Semitic arguments. You'll note he brought up the issue about loyalty. We make it abundantly clear that we think people who lobby on Israel's behalf are loyal Americans. We don't question their patriotism one bit. We argue that it's completely legitimate for people in the United States to lobby on behalf of whatever political interests they may have. And in fact, in the United States, you're allowed to have dual citizenship. You're even allowed to serve in foreign armies. So again, when you can't defeat our arguments, defeat the substance of our arguments, I think you're only left with two things. You either have to misrepresent those arguments, which has been widespread, or you have to try and smear us. Much the same way, by the way, Jimmy Carter was smeared when he published his book last year. The man who had done more for Middle East peace than just about anybody in history, had done more to make Israel more secure. Nonetheless, when he writes a book that's critical of the occupation, he's also smeared for being an anti-Semite sympathetic to Nazism. It's unfortunate.
Tom, I want to ask you a question. Are you saying that because of the history of anti-Semitism, that we cannot here in the United States criticize Israeli policy, and that we cannot point out that there is a lobby and that this lobby has an influence on Israeli foreign policy? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not making a case. I'm asking a question, but there is a lot of history behind all of us here, and I'm merely asking if you feel the weight and presence
that.
Of that
Nobody
history as you
that
make your
for
analysis.
One second. I want to be very clear on this. Both Steve and I understand the history of anti-Semitism very well, and we went to great lengths to make it clear in the article that we wrote and certainly in the book that we have now written that we are aware of this history and that we are not making arguments that bear any resemblance to those sorts of arguments you read in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
We're talking about interest group politics here. We're going to hear in
and
just a moment.
What the Israel lobby is doing is no different than what the National Rifle Association and the AARP are doing. And we can talk about the NRA and we can talk about the AARP, and there is no reason that we can't talk about the Israel lobby, especially when the consequences of its actions are so important for U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Let's go to a very high-profile example as you see it. You are very straightforward when it comes to the Iraq war. You say that the Israel lobby, especially the neoconservatives within it, was a principal driving force behind the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq in 2003. You say, but for the lobby's influence, there almost certainly would not have been this war. Stephen Walt, that's a big and hot charge, given how difficult this war has become. How do you justify it?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein originates with the neoconservatives. You can't find other groups within the United States who are pushing this, and they begin pushing it back in the late 1990s. The important thing to note here, of course, though, is that they were unable to persuade the Clinton administration to favor a war, and they were unable to persuade the Bush administration, in particular President Bush, to support going to war to overthrow Saddam Hussein until September 11th. So we don't argue that the lobby is solely responsible. We argue it was a critical element. Another critical element, of course, was
the principal driving force, you say. That's not solely responsible, but that is a large claim.
Absolutely. And again, Tom Friedman of the New York Times was quoted in Haaretz as saying that, look, if there are 25 people here in Washington who, if you'd exiled them to a desert island a few years ago, the war in Iraq would not have happened. That's not me saying it. That was Tom Friedman saying it.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you, and we're going to bring Ambassador Dennis Ross in for just a moment. Let me go to one call first. Shalom, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shalom, you're on the air.
Hi. I do not care if the authors are anti-Semitic or not. I think it's barking up the wrong tree.
Okay.
I care very much about their dismissing in half a sentence the what happened in Munich in 1938 when Czechoslovakia, whose safety was guaranteed by Great Britain and France, was sold down the river to Hitler. And Chamberlain came with a piece of paper, agreement with Hitler, said, I brought you peace with honor in our time. And Churchill said, you already lost your honor, you're going to lose your peace, and within less than a year, a World War II broke out.
Do you see Israel being sold down the river here, Shalom?
No, but the authors, in effect, their intentions may be the best. They're leading all the way to possible nuclear holocaust and hell. They're not discussing seriously what the president of Iran said. They're dismissing that one too in one sentence. He didn't mean it or mistranslated destruction of Israel. They are very cavalier from the Olympian academic heights. They don't address the issue that this, what would be perceived by the enemies of Israel, the 300 or 350 Arabs and over a billion Muslims, most of them hostile to Israel, they'll not take that seriously, that their advice in the chapter with the last heading borrowed from Lenin, what's to be done, is abandonment of Israel, which will be a signal of attack which will lead to World War III, very likely. They ignore it.
Shalom, thank you for your call. I want to leave that observation hanging there for just a moment. We will return to it. But let me turn right now, if I may, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, to Ambassador Dennis Ross. He joins us from Scottsdale, Arizona today. He served in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton as chief negotiator and advisor on Mideast affairs, currently a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Ross, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here today.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
You have debated Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer on their thesis. We'll look at some details, but give us your broad response first to what the case they're making in the Israel lobby.
Well, they know I've never accused them of being anti-Semitic, and I don't. That's not the tack I take in looking at what they've written. I do think that they are highly ideological, and I think they also don't allow reality to intrude into what is their ideological theory.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I've got a book out now on statecraft, and statecraft is about how you marry your objectives and your means and how you do reality-based assessments to shape those objectives and means. This administration, the Bush administration, has failed in statecraft. It hasn't failed because somehow the Israel lobby has pushed them into a war. They have failed because they don't define objectives clearly, they don't identify means clearly, they use ideology to shape their objectives and their means, and they don't let the facts confuse them. Now, take a look at what you were asking about the whole issue of Iraq, and the quote is, the principal driving force, the lobby was the principal driving force. You can quote Tom Friedman in Haaretz and talk about 25 people. If you had a different president, if Al Gore had been president and not George Bush, we would not have gone to war, whether there was an Israeli lobby or not an Israeli lobby.
What about your experience? You've been in the wheelhouse of U.S. policy when it comes to the Middle East, Israel, and the Palestinians. Did you see direct kind of intervention, influence, overwhelming guidance, steering by an Israel lobby?
Of course not. There's also a division here that one has to draw. The impact that the Israel lobby has in the Congress is one thing. The impact that it has on the executive branch of administrations is something very different. I won't say that there were never times when I would have to fly back from the Middle East and go to the Congress to justify or make a case for our policies because there had been lobbying on the Hill. But I will tell you, administrations that have to defend their policies, think through their policies, explain their policies, are actually stronger for having had to do it. So the fact is, there isn't a single time where we made a decision on the peace process because of the Israeli lobby. There isn't a single time that we shied away from making a decision on the peace process because of the Israeli lobby. Were we aware that there were voices out there and views out there? Of course. But the fact is, that's just not the way decisions are made. And I'm afraid that too much of what both John and Steve had written reflects too much detachment from the way policy is actually made.
Stephen Walt, how about it? So you've got a thesis. Dennis Ross doesn't see the facts on the ground to support it.
We obviously disagree about this one. I'd remind, I guess, Dennis, that Bill Clinton said that AIPAC was stunningly effective, better than anyone else lobbying in this town. And Newt Gingrich, who didn't agree with Bill Clinton on very much, said it was the most effective general interest group across the entire planet. Lee Hamilton, who served in Congress for 34 years, said there's no lobby group that matches it. Now,
is effective bad? Does that equal something negative? Effective?
Well, as I've said, as we've said before, this is a very powerful constraining force on any president, and certainly, as Dennis just conceded, has a tremendous impact in Congress. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why you saw that throughout the Oslo peace process that Dennis was intimately involved with. Although the United States was clearly interested in trying to bring the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a close, throughout that entire period, Israel doubled the size of the population occupying the West Bank, and the United States did nothing to stop it. We never made our aid conditional. We never told the Israelis that if they didn't stop building settlements and didn't stop expanding it, that we would start reducing our support. And that suggests that there's something constraining American politicians from doing what needs to be done in order to bring about a peace that would be good for Israelis and good for Palestinians alike, and, of course, very good for the United States.
Dennis Ross, your response?
I would like to respond to that. maybe if the two of you had done more time actually talking to people who were in administrations making policies, you would have a better feel for this. We didn't crack down on the issue of settlements because of the Israeli lobby. I'd be the first to tell you we should have taken a tougher posture. The reason we didn't take a tougher posture is because Yitzhak Rabin said to us, I don't have the political support to take on this issue as well. Don't push me too hard on this. This is someone who also said there are limits to how much I can do. He was also assassinated by someone who came out of the whole national settler movement. Barak, when we were talking to him at the when in advance of Camp David and afterwards, he said, look, I'm prepared to get out of almost all of the West Bank. Don't push me too hard on the settlements. Now, the fact is, we listened to them. Maybe we shouldn't have. My own view in retrospect is that we should have taken a different posture on the settlement issue because of the impact it would have not only on the Israelis but also on the Palestinians. But that was a judgment we made. Maybe the judgment was wrong, but it wasn't because the Israeli lobby was affecting us. And that's why I say maybe you should have not just looked at what political people will say when they speak to AIPAC, but also talk to people in administrations and ask them specifically, why did you make the decisions you make when you did them?
So, Dennis Ross, when Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer write that many policies pursued on Israel's behalf now jeopardize U.S. national security, do you agree?
You know, I don't. I mean, you wouldn't know when you listen to them that Israel withdrew unilaterally from Lebanon. You wouldn't know when you listen to them that Israel withdrew unilaterally from Gaza. In each case, Hezbollah claimed violence worked, diplomacy didn't. Hamas claimed violence worked, diplomacy didn't. Israeli unilateral moves were, in fact, a sign of weakness. The fact of the matter is, the Israelis are not always right. We should have had a different posture last summer on Lebanon. But the reality is also that they're living in a world that is a difficult world. When you read this book, what you find is they're pretty indifferent to the problems the Israelis face. Now, the fact is, when you negotiate peace, you actually have to be able to focus on the problems that both sides have. You have to meet the needs of both sides. I'm afraid that, you know, from the standpoint of a policymaker and from the standpoint of statecraft, when you're trying to marry objectives and means, the key is to do a reality-based assessment that takes into account the needs of all sides.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, chief negotiator and advisor on Middle East affairs under President H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, author of the new book, Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Ambassador Ross, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
John Mearsheimer, just a few seconds before the break, but your response?
Well, we're not indifferent to Israel's interests, but of course we're mainly concerned about the American national interest because we are Americans. And our argument is that these policies that the United States is pursuing largely on behalf of Israel are not in Israel's national interest or in the American national interest.
Let's take a call. Jeffrey in Des Moines, Iowa, you're on the air.
Through satellite TV, much of the world sees the United States through the prism of our support of Israel's occupation. And to buttress the professor's point, you know, if you look at United Nations resolutions, even that simply call for Israel to abide by the Geneva Conventions, the resolutions are typically vetoed by the United States, and in the General Assembly, the votes are usually about 180-2 with the U.S. and Israel on the other side. Another quick evidence of the power of AIPAC in Congress, when's the last time you heard a Republican or Democrat even use the word occupation or say something as simple as Israel has nuclear weapons? Last I'll say, don't look now, but AIPAC with both money and suits in Washington is pushing our country to use force against Iran.
Let's pick those up, Jeffrey, and thanks for your call. Stephen Walt, first to you on the congressional influence point. Dennis Ross concedes some of that. You quote in the book Stephen Rosen, former AIPAC official, later indicted for allegedly passing classified government documents to Israel. Talking with the New Yorker's Jeffrey Goldberg, he put a napkin in front of Goldberg and said, in 24 hours, we could have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin. How do you assess the impact of the lobby, as you see it, on congressional policy?
Well, it's quite clear that Israel is essentially immune from criticism on Capitol Hill. As the caller suggested, you're just not going to find congressmen who are willing to jeopardize their own careers. And the reason they're worried, of course, is if they get the reputation for being slightly critical of Israel, they run the risk that AIPAC and other groups will start trying to direct campaign contributions towards potential contenders. There are a number of famous cases where AIPAC has targeted congressmen or senators and driven them from office. Now, they don't succeed every time they try, obviously, but most people on Capitol Hill have gotten the message that this just isn't worth doing. And I should add, this is, again, the way sort of interest group politics in the United States works. If you've got an interest group that's well-organized and works 24/7 on an issue, and the rest of the population doesn't care as much about the issue, they can have a disproportionate impact. I would just add one other point. The caller mentioned the possibility of a war with Iran. Mm. Now, I want to be clear. First of all, the American Jewish population was less supportive of going to war in Iraq than the American people as a whole. So you shouldn't see that as something that was due to Jewish influence. And I would say the same thing about a war, possible military action against Iran. But it's quite clear that many of the same groups and individuals that were pushing us to go after Saddam Hussein back in 2002, 2003, have been leading the charge for us to take some kind of military action against Iran as well, and making many of the same arguments. And again, I think it would have many of the same negative consequences if they were to succeed.
The argument's been made that, Iran is Israel's greater fear. So if the Israel lobby were so powerful, why would the U.S. have gone into Iraq? That's not the number one Israeli concern. Is there a contradiction then, John, in you having described Iraq as the result of Israeli lobby influence?
No, Tom. It's quite clear that in early 2002, now remember we went into Iraq in March 2003. In early 2002, when the Israelis caught wind of the fact that we were seriously thinking about doing Iraq, that they came to Washington and told us that they would prefer that we do Iran first. The Israelis very clearly thought that Iran was a greater threat than Iraq. It's not that they were uninterested in having us effect regime change in Iraq and Syria. It's just that they preferred Iran. But once they came to understand that Iraq would be the first operation and we would subsequently deal with Iran and Syria, they embraced the idea of attacking Iraq, although they continually reminded us that we had to do Iran and Syria afterwards. So what you see from early 2002 up until the war starts in March 2003 is that the Israelis are pushing us very hard, harder than any other country outside the United States, to go to war against Saddam Hussein.
Let's go to Marla in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Marla, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I welcome the debate and open discussion that the Walter Mearsheimer book has raised, but I was wondering if they would comment on a different criticism of their book, which comes from people who are also who share their criticism of Israeli policy, which is to say, what about the oil interests? Why is it set up that the pro-Israel lobby is the power broker and not the oil interests in terms of U.S. policy?
Stephen Walt?
There's no question that oil is a vital American strategic interest, which is why the United States wants to prevent any hostile power from, say, taking over the Persian Gulf. But if you look carefully at it, it turns out that the energy lobby or the oil lobby doesn't have much impact on American Middle East policy. The oil companies, for example, opposed sanctions against Iran and against Iraq. In fact, Dick Cheney, when he was head of Halliburton, opposed the sanctions policy against Iran and complained that it was keeping American oil companies from making money in places like Iran. Oil companies, they care about things like environmental regulations, tax policy, whether they're going to get drilling leases in key places. They have not tended to drive things in terms of foreign policy. And this has been conceded, by the way, by a number of AIPAC officials who've said openly that they really don't face much opposition from the oil lobby. In fact, Doug Bloomfield, who was AIPAC's legislative head, told BBC News in 2002 that they had one great advantage advantage at AIPAC, which was simply that they didn't have much opposition. So again, the oil lobby, many people think, is very important. But if it were driving American policy in the Middle East, you'd see a very different policy than what we've had the last couple of decades. Mm.
Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, stand by. And Marla, thank you for your call. I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Joining us from Portland, Maine, is Aaron David Miller. He was an advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations between 1978 and 2003. He's currently a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, author of the book on U.S. Middle East policy coming out this next spring entitled America and the Much-Too-Promised Land, The Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You've also been right in the thick of this. You've seen the argument that Mearsheimer and Walt make. As somebody who's been right in the heart of it, do you agree with their assessment of what's gone on, what's going on?
It's a tough issue, and it's a tough issue to get right. First of all, you need a lot of honesty, clarity, and a lot of courage, particularly in a post-9/11 world, to do it, because the stakes for America, as the two professors point out, are very high. Listening over the past 45 minutes, however, I'm not sure that either the two professors nor my colleague Dennis Ross really has gotten it right. Based on 20 years of working in the system and over 160 interviews that I've done for my forthcoming book, The Much Too Promised Land, with our former presidents, secretaries of state, evangelicals, congressmen, senators, American Jews, Arabs, you really have to talk to the lobbied and the lobbyists in order to understand the real impact of domestic politics. I think the two professors have attached too much importance to domestic politics as a force on America's Middle East policy.
By domestic politics, do you mean the Israel lobby or something?
I mean the pro-Israeli community, which, as you know, is no longer simply the purview or the property of 5.3 million American Jews. It now extends to millions of evangelical Christians and millions of Americans who, over time, have come to identify with Israel. Frankly, most Americans don't care about this issue. But in a post-9/11 world, frankly, public opinion polling continues to support the notion that value affinity is still very much a part of the foundation on which the lobby and the pro-Israeli community base their arguments.
It's kind of a moral identification, a political identification.
You can call it moral. I call it value affinity. The perception, rightly or wrongly, that the Israelis are more or less like us. And in the post-9/11 world, democracies under the threat of suicide terror, that value affinity has merely deepened. But with respect to domestic politics, I think I just want to make two or three basic points to try to create some perspective here. Number one, the pro-Israeli community has a powerful voice. There's absolutely no question about that. I would argue that the debate in this country between the supporters of Israel and those who oppose Israel is essentially over. Most Americans and most politicians, in fact, all politicians of consequence, are either mildly, moderately, or strongly pro-Israel. But that powerful voice does not constitute a veto over policy making. And the impact of the pro-Israeli lobby or community is really uneven. In Congress, there's absolutely no question that you would not have the numbers in assistance to support the robust U.S.-Israeli relationship financially.
You're talking the $3 billion annual package.
Exactly. Without a highly organized and effective lobby, AIPAC and others, who essentially guard, in my judgment, a pre-existing tilt which is already entrenched and in Israel's favor. But the farther you move from Congress to the executive branch, which really ultimately does have control in shaping our policy, the less impact that domestic lobbies and interest groups really have. And I have to say that in the end, as realists, the two professors know this. When presidents lead, domestic lobbies or special interests usually follow, sometimes noisily, sometimes angrily, sometimes with great fights in the public arena.
So but are you saying there is a problem, but the problem is more with American executive leadership than with what you call domestic politics or lobbying?
I'm suggesting quite simply this, that our special relationship with Israel, so critical for reasons of value affinity and our influence in Arab-Israeli peacemaking, When that special relationship becomes what I would argue to you is an exclusive relationship, then American national interests in the Middle East have suffered. And it is the job of the President of the United States to define in the broadest possible terms what constitutes the national interest and to lead, preserving that special relationship with Israel, but also doing what is right for America. And when presidents have led, Nixon and Kissinger, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush and his very talented secretary, James Baker, on the issue of Arab-Israeli peacemaking, which is the one I know the best, Americans succeeded.
Let me get a response on this. John Mearsheimer, yes, there's influence here, says Aaron David Miller, but when presidents lead, they're free to lead.
Well, let me just start with the general point that I actually agree with a lot of what Aaron Miller says. And I certainly agree with his point that the lobby has a heck of a lot more influence on Capitol Hill than it has with the executive branch. But the fact of the matter is it has a lot of influence on the executive branch. Just think about the issue of settlements. Every president since Lyndon Johnson has stated that official American policy is to oppose the settlements, yet no American president has in any meaningful way tried to stop the settlement building enterprise. And the reason is that if any president did that, he or she would come in to serious political problems with the lobby. The lobby goes to great lengths to make sure that the United States has a one-sided policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians and the Israelis. Any presidential candidate or any president who talks about pursuing an even-handed policy regarding the Palestinians and the Israelis is going to get into serious trouble and very quickly back off from that position.
Let me take a call from Ken in Norwich, Connecticut. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I also agree with a lot of what Aaron Miller was saying as well. My view is that, and I think it's the point of the book, is that all lobbyists, by their nature of being a lobbyist, are to some great degree myopic. You don't become a lobbyist by having a varied opinion and being able to speak on many different topics. You become a lobbyist by pushing forth your idea or your view of the world.
So is that a problem for the U.S., for Israel, or not?
It's only a problem if there is no one willing to look at that Israel lobby critically. Because if you can look at the mining lobby critically, if you can look at the oil lobby critically, then you should be able to look at the Israel lobby critically. The problem is they've been very effective at what they do. They've been very effective at lobbying and putting forth only their idea, or it would seem, because if you come up as not pro-Israel, then you're anti-Semitic.
Ken, thanks very much for that. Aaron David Miller, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer argue this at the end of the book. They argue that it's time to treat Israel like a normal country, quoting them, and to make U.S. aid conditional on an end to the occupation and on Israel's willingness to conform its policies to American interests. Would you argue that?
I think that America has demonstrated, first of all, I don't believe that we really are an honest broker when it comes to Arab-Israeli peacemaking. The question is whether or not we can become an effective broker. We're not an honest broker because, in truth, we have a very close and special relationship with Israel, which continues to get stronger. I would argue to you that that is the, frankly, the politically incorrect secret of American influence in Arab-Israeli peacemaking. Believe me, if we had no relationship with the Israelis, our phone would not continue to ring at a time when our credibility from one end of the Middle East to the other as a consequence of the Middle East policies of this administration lies in tatters. No, we are able to be an effective broker at times because of our relationship with the Israelis. So we need to maintain that relationship. At the same time, that special relationship, and I'll say it again, cannot become an exclusive relationship. Somebody in government needs to identify what constitutes an American national interest. And on the question of Arab-Israeli peacemaking or other issues, including settlement activity, try to find the right balance when it comes to American policy.
Aaron David Miller, the book coming out in the spring is Too Much Promised Land. Our time is short. We're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us. Stephen Walt, the last word goes to you. Do you see U.S. policy moving in a new direction, gaining more independence by your lights from Israel, the Israel lobby as you define it, or not?
I agree with much of what Aaron said. We have the potential to be a force for great good in that region, but it's going to require greater independence from the views of many of the key organizations in the Israel lobby. I hope listeners will read our book, see what we have to say there, and I think they'll discover that we are advocating a set of policies that would be much better for the United States and also better for Israel's interest as well.
Stephen Walt at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, thank you for joining us. And John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago, thank you for being here.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
The book is The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.